There is a little favour I would like to ask of all of you to begin with, please, and I do mean every single person in the room. No opting out. I would like to ask you all, please, for 30 seconds of abuse. Newspaper called the Daily Mail, not one of our better newspapers, not the worst either, sad to say, but they irritated me in that they wanted to know what I would do if I'd won their £1 million bingo competition. I immediately replied that I would give it to John Cleese, so they take my afternoon off. They thought that was quite funny, but a little cruel, and printed a watered-down version of the joke in the newspaper the next day, which annoyed me intensely. But they also mentioned that I would like to go to the Andes. Now, I had, in fact, mentioned the Andes in talking to them, because I used to climb a little bit, and they saw fit to publish that. Well, the same day that this article appeared, I had a telephone call from a gentleman called David Kirk, who said he was the chairman of the Dangerous Sports Club, and he wondered if I would like to go hang gliding over active volcanoes in Ecuador. I said, no. But I was kind of interested in that I hadn't had many phone calls like that before. Well, I chatted the man a bit and got to know a little bit about the group, and subsequently did agree to go to Ecuador with the group. I realized at the time I was probably being used as some kind of useless mascot, perhaps to gain a little extra sponsorship money, that sort of thing, and agreed that I would only go for 1 week, however. I'd arranged lots of very important meetings that I said I had to attend, totally fictitious, but I wanted to make sure that my time there was going to be limited, so that I wouldn't have to, the chances of me having to do anything dangerous were also limited. And I arrived in Ecuador. Now, Ecuador is quite a tall sort of place. Quito, the capital city, is some 10,000 feet above sea level, and I found that bending down to tie up shoelaces gave me quite a headache. Of course, I imagined that climbing any of the mountains around there to hang glide off them would involve a little bit in the way of acclimatization to altitude, because a lot of volcanoes in that country are 20,000 feet or so in height. But of course, the Dangerous Sports Club don't believe in acclimatization. They would prefer to do things with the headaches. Towards the end of that week, I thought I was going to get away with not having done anything at all dangerous, but they did suggest that perhaps I should climb up one mountain called Cotopaxi, which is somewhat over 20,000 feet in height. It is a volcano, so it's that sort of shape. It's not particularly technically difficult as a climb, but it is rather tall. And also the other problem about climbing this mountain is you have to climb it at night, because it is on the equator, and if you're on the mountain after about 8 o'clock in the morning, then the sun tends to melt the snow and ice above you, and it then tends to fall on you. We set out from a mountaineering hut at about 15,000 feet with considerable headaches at about 11 o'clock at night, and climbed on up. I must say it was one of the most physically exhausting things I've ever attempted. It really was a matter of taking six incredibly deep breaths every step, that kind of thing, because we were none of us acclimatized and indeed had wonderfully thumping headaches. But we got to within about 1,000 feet of the summit when, sadly, one of the members of our party of four developed altitude sickness. And so, obviously, the sensible thing was to come back down again, particularly as the leader of the group had lost his way. The reason for this little jaunt, really, was to find out how difficult it was going to be to carry hang gliders up there, and obviously the answer was very. Well, we came back down again, and shortly after I left and returned to England. The group did stay on, though, and subsequently did get to the top of Mount Chimborazo, which is somewhat higher, and they did carry some hang gliders up there, although they found when they reached the summit that the snow was well above waist deep, and so consequently you couldn't really run to take off. They merely hung around up there long enough to get frostbite and then came back down again. That expedition not being particularly successful from a hang gliding point of view, they do intend to go back in a year's time. There is one mountain which they have their eyes on called Sangay, and that conveniently erupts every 10 minutes or so. And that's very much the place the Dangerous Sports Club are aiming for. They're interested in the kind of conceivable updrafts that you would get from this volcano. It's a bit of a problem to climb up because every 10 minutes red-hot boulders roll down. I don't know whether I shall join them on that expedition. We'll see. Anyway, I arrived back in England and found that I felt guilty that I'd been made a member of this club and hadn't actually done anything dangerous. It's a curious sort of guilt. But I had got to know the group of people and found that they were very varied. On the one extreme to the out-of-work English person, and on the other, a member of a member of British aristocracy in a way, I suppose, in that he was kind of a third cousin or something of Queen Elizabeth. With the extraordinary name of Zan FitzAlan Herbert. And he really gave meaning to the word inbred. quite a loony. A very nice loony, but loony nonetheless. And in between those two extremes, quite a variety of people, but they all had one thing in common, and that is that they all like to do things which scare them a bit. They like to do things to which there's an unacceptable risk attached. They were adrenaline junkies, basically. Anyway, feeling guilty that I'd been made a member of the club and not having done any of it, you're supposed to do three events. You're supposed to take part in three official Dangerous Sports Club events, really, before becoming a proper member. So I did decide that I would go to St. Moritz for their winter sports that year. In the knowledge that I would be adult enough to say no if it looked too stupid, too dangerous, and I wasn't going to succumb to peer pressure and take part in something which would end in an injury or worse. So I arrived in Switzerland to find that the Dangerous Sports Club had already had difficulty getting into Switzerland because at the border they'd been prevented access because David Kirk hadn't paid his hospital bill from the previous year. Once that was squared up, they were allowed in. And I arrived at the top of a snow slope. Now, the rules for the Dangerous Sports Club winter sports are that it is an uncontrolled descent of a snow slope. There has to be something interposed between yourself and the skis, thus rendering control impossible. And the normal method of stopping, of course, being the crash. points are given, really, for imagination in terms of what it is that's placed between yourself and the skis. It can be anything from a wheelchair to a grand piano. I found them at the top of this slope grumbling to the organisers that they'd been given too gentle a slope. Now, it looked fine to me. No problems with it, but apparently this wasn't steep enough or not bumpy enough and interesting enough for them. They insisted, and the organisers unfortunately agreed to give them another slope, and in fact gave them the end of a black ski run. Now, a black ski run is the nastiest kind of ski run, and the most senior sort, and indeed it was a lot steeper, with a lot more bumps on it, and also there was no runoff area at the bottom, just a sort of drop with some trees poking up. Now, I was getting ready to be very adult about this picture. The item they chosen for me to go down the slope, and I suppose they thought it was appropriate because of my medical background, they thought it would be a great idea if I were to go down on an operating table on skis. The idea of lying flat on my back on this thing, staring up the sky while hurtling a black ski run did not appeal. So I was very adult about that and said no. I won't go down on that thing, thank you very much. But that made me feel guilty again, and so I then felt that I ought to go down on something perhaps, and I did look around for the safest, slowest looking vehicle is what I was looking for. And in fact, that turned out to be, in my mind, a 15-foot long wooden Venetian gondola, which they borrowed from some Italian restaurant. If I was going to go down the slope, that was going to be it, because it looked slow. And also, there are no nasty metal bits sticking out of it, sticking to you or anything. So that was what I was going to do. Anyway, the first 10 or so members of the Dangerous Sports Club set off down the slope on wheelchairs, on skis, and only one of them was lucky enough to reach the bottom, and he was very fortunate in that he hit a tree. The next item down the slope was a full-scale replica of a cruise missile. This had two people on board, and because of its design, of course, was very aerodynamic. That successfully reached the bottom of the slope, and they were very fortunate too, in that the front of their machine merely crumpled up on impact with a tree. So, no real injuries so far, just a few bruises and minor scratches and so on. So, everything was going well. But the next person down the slope was not quite so fortunate. He had had a Formula 3 race car. This didn't have its skin, it didn't have its sort of outer shell, but it was basically a Formula 3 race car. And of course, these machines are designed to withstand impact. But he didn't want to wear the harness that the device was providing him. He thought it would be much better for him if he was thrown out of it when he crashed. And also wasn't keen to wear a safety helmet either. All of us, though, thought that was sensible and persuaded him eventually to wear a helmet. He set off down the slope and did gather up considerable speed. Unfortunately, about two-thirds of the way down, he must have caught on some projection or other, the skis on this machine, and it promptly turned three or four cartwheels, and he was indeed thrown out of the machine. Unfortunately, part of the steering wheel passed through his left thigh as he was thrown out, and he came to rest in a heap on the ground and didn't move for several minutes. About 4 minutes later, I suppose, the paramedics on skis arrived at the scene, and by then he was beginning to stagger to his feet. But he subsequently had loss of memory for some 5 days after this event. And it occurred to me at the time, that's probably why he turns up every year. Completely forgot to turn last time. Anyway, this little crash had cast quite a pall over the proceedings, particularly amongst the spectators. And I suppose David Kirk, thinking of this, decided that he ought to go down the slope next, just to cheer everyone up, and as chairman of the club. And his vehicle was a C5, which is a little electric car developed by a man in England called Clive Sinclair. Not a very commercial success at all. In fact, not a commercial success, but on skis, it was very aerodynamic. And David really shot down the slope. And he, too, must have hit some projection or other and came to an abrupt halt partway down the slope. And didn't move for several minutes. When he did get out and stagger around, there was a trickle of blood coming from his left temple, and it was my turn next. It's a curious thing, this peer pressure, but I found myself, for some reason or other, sitting optimistically in the back of this gondola. Optimistic's the wrong word, really. Worried. Sitting next to me was Zan Fitzalan Herbert. Not much comfort there. Zan turned to me at that point and said, "Looks like a bit of a brown trouser job this afternoon." Which did little to improve my state of mind. And sitting in the front of the gondola was Eric. Now, Eric is the Dangerous Sports Club mascot, and he is in the shape of a man, totally bandaged from head to foot, has eyes that swivel, always smokes a little cigarette, and for some reason or other wears a pair of boxer shorts, beneath which is what can only be described as an erection. A rather mobile erection. They use Eric to annoy people in restaurants. at which he is singularly successful. Well, Well, anyway, Zan, myself, and Eric were pushed off from the top of this slope in this gondola, and by the second bump, we were airborne. The thought broken leg went through my mind, I distinctly remember, and I soon found myself flying over Zan's head, and then noticed Zan flying over my head. And then we were both pursued down the slope by this wretched wooden gondola. Try and kick away to avoid further injury. And we both finished up badly winded, but alive! And that felt great. I mean, I was thoroughly elated, totally full of adrenaline, I suppose. And it really did put the whole world in perspective there for me suddenly. I mean, the bank manager was no longer important. I could have rung him up and told him he was a fool. It didn't. The whole world was in perspective. And I felt good for 2 weeks after that event. I was beginning to realise what a charge these people got out of their weird activities. Later on that afternoon, though, I was glad that one event didn't take place that Zan had rather hoped would. He had brought along with him that afternoon for the downhill event a London double-decker bus, which he had enormous skis made, and suggested that wouldn't it be a great idea if at the end of the afternoon we all piled into this bus. I thought not. Thankfully, also, the local mayor thought not as well. He was worried there was a local election that week, and was worried, I think, conceivably about an ecology issue, in that damage might have been caused to certain trees, and for that matter, hotels, by this machine. So it was forbidden entry on the slope, thankfully, quite a relief. But anyway, I got back to England after this event, and certainly I knew, about the buzz that you could get from these activities, but I was by no means an adrenaline addict yet. And it wasn't for another year until I agreed to take part in another of their activities, which happened to be in the nature of a catapulting event. Now, this was for charity, and it was held in Hyde Park in London, part of Bob Geldof's Sport Aid Day for Africa. And I'll describe exactly what happened to me. I decided this time, incidentally, to arrive late. I really didn't want to have all the business of hanging around, having to put up with a lot of brown trouser talk before taking part again. So I arrived late in the hope that they would be absolutely ready for me, and indeed they were. And I arrived in Hyde Park and was put into this climbing harness, and then an enormous 150-foot crane lowered down three strands of aircraft carrier elastic, the sort of heavy stuff they stop for aircraft going off the end of aircraft carriers with. That was attached to the front of my climbing harness, and then from behind, I was attached by another rope to a large concrete block set in the ground. The crane then raised itself up to its full height. The man standing next to me then said, "There are one or two things you ought to know." He said, "You will be experiencing a force of some 6G, so you'll have to hold your hands behind your head like that, otherwise you will get whiplash, not might, but will." When you get to the top of your flight, he said, "You'll notice these coils of rope sort of floating around beside you. Don't get tangled up in those, otherwise you'll strangle yourself." And then, when you get to the bottom of your flight, remember to hold your arm in front of your face like that, otherwise the rope could smash you in the nose or the eye. And one of our guys lost partial sight in one eye the other week, and with that he said, "Count to five." I don't remember getting any further than four, but the decision was taken out of my hands, and the rope behind me was slashed with a knife, and I just went, "Ning!" And I don't remember much about the way up, either. Also very quick. But I do remember arriving up at the sort of top of my arc, as it were, and floating around for what seemed like an age. I suppose I was so full of adrenaline by then. And sure enough, I saw these coils of rope floating around beside me and thought, well, surely by now I should be. And then I was. Being so full of adrenaline, I certainly did remember to hold my arm up in front of my face, preventing any possible damage that way, and then found myself merely bouncing up and down on the end of the rope, and was able to do kind of moon hops on the ground and everything, and again, I felt thoroughly exhilarated after that experience. It was like the best fairground rider ever. It really was quite amazing. They've been quite kind to me. In fact, 6G, in their eyes, wasn't too bad, and I'd only gone up to a height of about 100 feet or so. They quite regularly exert far more than 6G, even going up to 11, which is practically blackout time, and going above the crane, but not to me. They were kind to me, thankfully. However, I haven't yet taken part in my third activity, which I suppose I will have to do at some point, and that will be a jump on a bungee cord from a bridge, I suppose. But I did go along with the thought I might take part in that event one afternoon to a village in Oxfordshire in England. Again, it was a little local charity event. And David Kirk had a huge crane there again and was going to do bungee jumping from a bucket suspended from this 150-foot crane. And I went up in the bucket with him just to see what the ground looked like from up above, and to me it looked like concrete. So, began to have doubts at that point. And then I descended, and David went up again with a sack full of half ends of bricks and so on, weighing the same as himself, just to test out the rope. And he threw that out from the bucket, and promptly the thing smashed on the concrete. And I thought, perhaps this isn't the afternoon for me to do that particular event. So that is still sometime in the future for me, and I've insisted that it will be over water. I decided it would make a very good subject for a full adventure movie, and I've in fact written a movie script about the Dangerous Sports Club. I think it will be the first adventure movie without special effects. Or insurance. Anyway, hope to get that going sometime within the next couple of years. David Kirk has had a little bit of bother in the last year. In fact, he had a court case he was obliged to attend in that the Civil Aviation Authority in Britain had prosecuted him for travelling between England and France in the pouch of a 25-foot-high inflatable kangaroo. He evidently didn't have the appropriate licence for this. He was sighted at the height of some 10,000 feet by a passing airliner, who duly felt obliged to report him as a near miss to the Civil Aviation Authority, and I subsequently went along to a courtroom in Eastbourne in England to act as a character witness for David, thus perjuring myself. We nevertheless got him off with a small fine. His next ballooning activity intends to fly between the United States and England. He intends to fly on the back of a 75-foot wingspan helium-inflated Pegasus, an enormous flying horse. He intends to sit on the back of this thing in high-altitude climbing clothes and fly at an altitude of, again, of some 10,000 feet or so, some 4.5 to 5 days, to land in London or Kiev or somewhere. Good luck to him on that one. Another member of the club, an American member, in fact, who works for NASA, is very keen to do a freefall jump from 150,000 feet, which is quite a height and somewhat of a record, should he do it. But he's very keen to do this. He's worked out all the appropriate mathematics of the occasion, the physics of the occasion. He will arrive at 150,000 feet suspended beneath a hydrogen balloon. He'll be wearing a full pressurized spacesuit. He will sever connection with the helium balloon at that point and then merely plummet. And has calculated that by the time he reaches the height of 50,000 feet, he will personally be travelling at 1,100 miles an hour. It should be an interesting afternoon out. Anyway, the Dangerous Sports Club. I seem to have made a habit of getting involved with dangerous people in one way or another. And I remember that one very dear friend, no longer with us, but a gentleman by the name of Keith Moon, who was, of course, the drummer for the group The Who. Quite a wild character indeed. And I first met Keith at a charity soccer match in England. It was, in fact, Monty Python versus the rest of the world. And Keith was playing for the rest of the world. I didn't play soccer. I used to play rugby football, and I was rather bored with the way that the other people were taking the game rather seriously. I thought that, on the whole, the audience had come along there that afternoon to see us all make fools of ourselves. Really, that was the idea of the occasion, I thought. But with that in mind, I've gone along dressed as the Colonel figure from the Python series and just generally made a nuisance of myself. Wandering around, barking orders and shouting at people, standing in the goal mouth, generally being obstructive. And Keith must have felt similarly bored by the way the game was going, because he left the field at one point and then drove back on in someone's car. And scored several goals. That led to a kind of instant rapport between the two of us. And we then went to a bar and drank very, 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 very many drinks together. And I introduced him then to a game which I'd like to show you all now. It's something I'm trying to popularise around the world, so I'll show it to you if I may. All you need for it is a glass. Actually, it's a Budweiser mug, I see, but that's fine. And some coins. Three coins. I need a couple of volunteers too, really. How about you and you? You just sort of stand over there and watch. I'll demonstrate to you. Okay, yeah, about there. That'll be fine. Now, it is an old medical student's game, so it is somewhat proctological. You take three coins and place them somewhat perineally. and then walk like this. Walk across the grass. Now, this is the tricky bit. Position yourself carefully. Should be about right. Oh dear. Oh, attention. The next time I met Keith, he was staying at a hotel in London called the Londonderry. Not a particularly huge hotel. In fact, it was the only hotel in London at the time which would allow him to stay at it. But Keith was staying in a penthouse suite of this hotel. And I arrived on the top floor and knocked on Keith's door, and Keith opened it, and there were two or three Swedish girls there. I don't know what they were doing, probably helping him tidy up or something. Anyway, Keith immediately apologised that he had no gin in the room. He knew that was my drink at the time, and gave me a bottle of lager to be going on with, and then rang down to room service and asked them to send up a bottle of gin. Well, some 10 minutes and about four or five lagers later, there was still no sign of this gin arriving in the room. And so Keith rang room service again and told them that if the gin didn't appear in his room within the next 5 minutes, then their television set would appear on the pavement. He was very strict like that. Well, a few moments later, still no sign of the gin, and Keith had wandered over to the side of the room and had climbed out of the window onto what I assumed was a balcony outside. I didn't know what he was up to, but I was partway through a lager, so I'm too bothered. what a strange person. Still no sign of him coming back in, so I wandered over to the window to have a look to see what he was doing out there. And looked out, and there was no balcony. There was no sign of Keith either. There was no mess on the pavement beneath. All there was, in fact, was a ledge about 4 or 5 inches wide, no more, about 4 feet beneath the window, and evidently he must have climbed around the building on this ledge. Certainly something I would never have contemplated. But it was Keith, so what he bothered, I sat back down, opened up another lager, and nearly waited. Well, after I finished that lager, Keith reappeared at the window carrying a bottle of Beefeater gin. He walked in and plonked it on the table in front of me, and evidently he had burgled the next door penthouse. And I thought, well, there's a friend. Incidents involved himself at hotels. In fact, one hotel in Los Angeles, the Hyatt House on Sunset Strip, he was returning home one afternoon after having rehearsed with the band in the morning and was listening to a cassette recording of the rehearsal as he walked through the lobby. And evidently there was some kind of complaint about this, and the manager therefore approached him and told him to turn that noise off, please. Well, Keith immediately obliged, turned it off, and went up to his room, where he happened to have a large supply of detonator caps. He'd been saving these up for the act later on in the week. And he spent the next 20 minutes meticulously wiring these up to the back of his door. He then rang down to the manager's office and told the manager he wanted to see him immediately. Then waited, he popped his head out of the door and checked that the manager had indeed just stepped out of the elevator, then went back in again, and the manager arrived outside Keith's door, see the whole door blown off its hinges, and his face, and Keith stepping out of the rubble and smoke, holding up this cassette recorder, saying, "That was noise, mate, this was the Who." he certainly had a way with authority. If anyone had a question or two, yeah.
Would you see any more Python ever?
Will you see any more Python ever? Well, there are one or two little bits that haven't been seen yet. In fact, there are two shows we made, two 15-minute shows we made for German television. Sounds bizarre, doesn't it? And it was quite bizarre, actually, going to Germany. And the first show we actually did in German, we learnt it phonetically, the script, which was quite tricky. And German, we discovered, really, it wasn't a language designed for jokes, on the whole. The structure of the language is somewhat cumbersome in many respects. Just one simple little example. I had a character to play, a sort of Frau Munt, I think she was called, who was a Mrs. Mouth, I think that is. Anyway, who was a contestant in a kind of stake your claim panel game thing. And people came onto this panel show to make monstrous claims, such as they'd written the whole of Shakespeare and things like that. But my claim, as Frau Munt, was that I could burrow through an elephant. That sounds, you know, silly enough in normal English, but in German it is das ich durch ein Elefanten graben kann, which literally translated is that I, through an elephant, burrow. Kind of the wrong way round. the same sort of ring to it. That was an odd experience, but there are, as I say, there are two 50-minute specials made in Germany. The second one we did in English, and they subsequently dubbed it into German. That was a lot easier. And some quite interesting material from those shows. In fact, little bits of that have been seen. I think the Philosopher's Football episode was taken from that. But as to anything absolutely new, it's anyone's guess, really. Who knows? None of us do. I think in terms of movies, well, I'll talk a little bit about movies and the genesis of them, and that perhaps give you some idea of the kind of predicament we're all in as far as doing more work together is concerned. After Holy Grail, we all went to Paris one day to see what we all sounded like in French, I suppose, and went to a restaurant, a Chinese restaurant that evening, and chatted about what we would do next, what would the next movie be about. We thought perhaps they could find the Grail and maybe we could take it on from there. Then Eric Idle came up with a monstrous suggestion, which we said no, but laughed at. Anyway, his suggestion for a title for the next movie was Jesus Christ Lust for Glory. No, we can't possibly do that. But that did give us the thought, wait a minute, something set in that period, in the times of Christ, would be a very good area for us to work in. Particularly as we'd done most of the research, you know, we'd all read the Bible. And indeed, that was originally going to be the Gospel according to St. Brian. St. Brian was going to be a kind of 13th apostle who was always late turning up for miracles and things. But it fell to John Cleese and myself to write some of the opening material for this movie, and we clearly thought at that time that we ought to write a nativity scene at some point or other. You know, that would be our job. And we couldn't quite see how to write a nativity scene, because obviously that would involve Mr. Christ. with whom we had absolutely no quarrel at all. I mean, pretty nice person. They didn't put many fingers wrong at all, we didn't think, you know. Generally agreed with his teachings and very good person indeed. He got a little bit tetchy once when I think he caused either a fig tree or a olive bush to be withered or something, but that was only a little fit of pique. Everyone has an off day. But otherwise, perfect. I mean, the man was absolutely irreproachable, so no problem with him or his teachings. Wonderful, wonderful. And that's really why we wanted to write the movie, because we felt that the churches subsequently had rather missed the central point of his arguments, that in fact people should love one another, and got rather diverted into joining separate little clubs wearing different clothing and thinking of themselves as being rather special and those other people over there as not being worthy of going to heaven, whereas we are, you know. We rather felt wasn't very Christian of them. But anyway, that we felt was a very, very fertile area. So in conclusion to that little section I was talking about, the writing the nativity scene, our solution to that was that we thought of the three wise men going to the wrong manger, and therefore that was Brian's manger, and therefore followed Brian throughout the rest of the movie, which is exactly what we did. But then after Life of Brian, which turned out to be, fortunately, partly because of the bigots that complained about it, turned out to be a very successful venture. Very nice of them, they did all the publicity for us. And it was interesting to note that they felt quite capable of complaining, these various bodies of church organisations, complaining about the movie without ever having seen it. But then, of course, that's the prerogative of a bigot, isn't it? Anyway, they did complain very vociferously, and so we had to do no publicity at all. Because of the success of that, I suppose, we were all gathered with a manager that we had at the time, the financial manager, who also happened to be George Harrison's financial manager, who made a suggestion which caused one or two people to change their minds about whether to do another movie or not. I mean, at that moment, I was thinking, well, I've got, you know, there are other things that I want to do myself. Wasn't thinking we would get down to writing another movie immediately. That wasn't the normal pattern of things, and John McPhee certainly was usually rather reticent about joining in with future Python activities at that stage. He'd got Faulty Towers going with and all that sort of thing. A very good series, I thought. But anyway, didn't imagine that John would be interested, but there is a kind of, well, shall I say, venal side to John's nature. And when this gentleman, the manager, suggested to us that if we all went ahead and started work on another movie immediately, then none of us would ever have to work again. John's eyes kind of lit up. When should we start? So everyone kind of immediately then thought, yeah, okay, well, we'll start writing. And we did begin writing what was later to become The Meaning of Life, but we wrote for 2 years in a complete vacuum. We'd no idea what we were writing, really. Some of us thought we were writing about the First World War, some of the Second World War, some Third World War. Some thought it was about school. Some of us thought it was about a mysterious tiger hunt in India. But after 2 years of a very frustrating writing period, which I don't think any of us are anxious to repeat, after that, we'd still come up with no sort of unifying theme, and we were all then shipped off to Jamaica for a couple of weeks with the idea that all six of us would stay in one house and with no wives, friends, or dental appointments or anything like that to interrupt us. We would then come up with the notion that would unify this disparate material. And after about 5 days of very hard thinking, we still hadn't come up with any ideas at all, so we thought, well, let's not bother, let's have a holiday. And that kind of freed up the mind, particularly of Terry Jones, who then suggested, how about calling it The Meaning of Life? And we thought, well, that's kind of an outrageous enough title. And it also suited some of the better material we'd written up to that point, in that it slotted into a kind of seven or eight Ages of Man theme. So that's what it became, The Meaning of Life. But as I said, I don't think any of us particularly need to go back to that kind of process of writing. The most important thing, as far as another movie is concerned, and I think we'd all kind of like to do another movie at some point, is that we have an idea which we can all say, ah yes, that'll be easy to write. if it's easy to write, chances are it'll be quite good too. It'll be fun to write. So that's the most important factor. Otherwise, I think it's very doubtful whether we get together for any television work. We are all six very different people. We are all involved in our own individual projects. And so I think it is unlikely that we get together for anything like that. But a movie at some point in the future is a possibility. Another question? Yeah.
out of all the experiences in your life, anything that came out of being particularly outrageous?
Particularly outrageous? Oh, yes, there were a lot of outrageous things that tended to happen to me, particularly in those hazy alcohol days. Yes, there were. I do remember once in... I went to the Polo Lounge in the Beverly Hills Hotel, and for some reason or other, I don't quite know why, decided that the people in the Polo Lounge were... I suppose I felt that they perhaps didn't care all that much about less fortunate people in the world. I don't know how I got that feeling. Anyway, it did get to me in my drunken state. And I decided at that point that I was going to be paralyzed from the waist down. And informed the waiter that I wanted a wheelchair because I'd just suddenly become paralyzed. He didn't believe me, of course, because he'd seen me walk in. But I told him, no, this is a joke, but I'm playing it to the hilt. I am not going to move from the waist down. It may be a joke, but I'm not going to move from the waist down from this point on, so would you get me a wheelchair? And he was somewhat reluctantly eventually obliged to get a wheelchair and wheel me out of the Beverly Hills Hotel. I had got at that stage, because I was there publicizing some movie, they provided me with a limo and a driver who was waiting outside for me. But the waiter, I think, was rather annoyed that I was, he thought I was up to something, obviously. And we didn't get quite as far as the limo before it stopped. And obviously, you weren't going to go any further. You weren't going to go through with this joke and help me into the car or anything. He just left me there. So I thought, well, I will take it through to its extremity. And fortunately for me, they also had a fundraiser for some political organization at the time. So a lot of very poor people were arriving. I merely then threw myself to the ground from this wheel and crawled using hands only into the back of the limo. Which I don't think did much for the reputation of the waiter or the Beverly Hills Hotel. Certainly hope not. Another question. Yeah.
Have you known the other Python members for a long time?
Yes. First met John Cleese when I arrived at Cambridge University and was trying to join a club called the Footlights Club, or Review Society, which I think is, I suspect, the real reason why I went to Cambridge in the first place rather than Metz, but I wouldn't admit that at the time. Yes, we both joined that Review Society together at the same time. Eric Idle joined that subsequently, about a year later, and so three of us knew each other from Cambridge, and two of the others, Michael Palin and Terry Jones, were all performing at the Fringe of the Edinburgh Festival one year, and finished up working on the same television programme, writing scripts for a programme called The Frost Report, hosted by a gentleman called David Frost, a very modest gentleman, David Frost. His programme, as you know, was called The Frost Report, and the credits at the end of the programme read, starring David Frost in huge letters, and written by David Frost in huge letters, and then about 30 other names just went poof, and we five were amongst those 30 names. And I suppose we got to know each other at that period, really, and also shared the frustration of taking along scripts to this to script meetings, and they would be read out by the cast, who would laugh at these scripts quite a lot, and then say, oh, we can't do that, it's too stupid. Or it's too filthy, or whatever. They were worried about their image. Well, we weren't bothered at all about our image. Not that we had any at the time, anyway, but we eventually, subsequently, did use quite a bit of that material that was written at that point in later Python shows. And then we were joined, of course, by Terry Gilliam. Now, Terry Gilliam originally comes from Minneapolis. He was educated, I think, in Occidental in California, and met us via John Cleese. John Cleese and I were once in a stage review called Cambridge Circus, which was on in New York for a time, and Terry Gilliam saw this show and was looking for someone for a cartoon that he was producing at the time for a magazine. He wanted, in fact, the ideal city jet. He wanted the epitome of a London city jet, a bowler-hatted type with pinstripe trousers and rolled-up umbrella. And thought John Cleese would suit this role exactly, and asked John if he would pose for a sort of photo montage for this cartoon strip that he was doing. And instead, the storyline of the photo montage was about a city gent who has an affair with a Barbie doll. So there are in existence some rather nice photographs of John Cleese doing naughty things to a Barbie doll. Which I always cherish and keep locked away in a drawer just in case John gets stroppy. And when Terry decided that he ought to avoit that rather nasty bit of business in the Vietnamish area of the world, he came over to England very sensibly to avoid that. And John put him in touch with a few friends who happened to be Michael Palin, Terry Jones, Eric Idle, who were working on a children's television program called Do Not Adjust Your Set. And he worked with them on that program and subsequently with those three, all four of them joined John and myself when we were considering doing a new television program, and that turned out to be Monty Python. So that's how it all happened. It's interesting, though, with Terry Gilliam, John often used to rip him about his, we all did, I suppose, about his use of English language, and that it was, limited. There was a sort of paucity there. In fact, John claimed that his vocabulary stretched to about 30 words. he was very good visually, extremely good visually, as evidence of his excellent direction of several movies. Very good visually, but the word department was not really his. I remember, John used to say that things for Terry would either be really great or they would really piss him off. Not many shades of meaning in between that. I remember on one occasion we were doing a stage tour of Canada, a theatrical tour of Canada, and we were flying over Lake Superior one day, and Terry looking down at Lake Superior and then turning around to the rest of us and saying, "Hey, you guys, a whole bunch of water." Fairly adequately sum up the lake. Still, we used actually to self-censor quite a lot. I mean, we were quite responsible. I mean, although there was one sketch I remember writing with John Cleese which we actually felt guilty about when we were writing it. Consequently, we laughed hysterically. But it concerned a gentleman who had a little problem in that his mother had recently died, and he wondered how to dispose of it, and went along with his mother in a sack, we're giggling already, to an undertaker's establishment, and advised by the undertaker that there were only three things he could do with his mother, quite logically. She could be burnt, buried, or dumped, you see. Well, being burnt means, he explained, being put into the flames, crackle, 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 which is not too nice, particularly if you're not quite dead. And being buried means being stuffed into the ground and eaten up by lots of worms and weevils and things, nibble, 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 which again is not too pleasant a demise for the dear departed. Then the third possibility being dumped, merely being thrown into the Thames or some such. And he didn't regard that as really dignified enough for his mother. But then the undertaker came up with a fourth possibility, and that suggestion was that they could eat her. Well, by now we were laughing hysterically. pure guilt. But the man, of course, wasn't keen on this notion, but the undertaker then went on to encourage him by saying she'd be delicious with a few French fries, a bit of broccoli on the side. And said, "Well, I am a bit peckish, but no, no." And then the undertaker suggested, "Look, I tell you what, we can eat your mum, and then we'll dig a grave, and if you feel guilty about it afterwards, you can throw up in it." By then, we had gone too far. And the BBC thought so too, and wouldn't allow us to perform that sketch unless we were attacked by the audience at the end of it. So we rather artificially had to arrange for the audience, the section of the studio audience, to attack us at the end of the sketch, which was a mystifying moment, a really strange moment indeed. Talk a little bit about the way we used to write together. I used to write mostly in conjunction with John Cleese. Michael Payne and Terry Jones used to write together, although quite often in different houses. I don't know how they managed that. Eric Idle would write on his own, and Terry Gilliam, of course, was responsible for the animations and so on. And John, my habit was to work either at my house or at his, and arrive about 10 o'clock in the morning, and I was usually about half an hour late, even in my own house. nevertheless, when we eventually started to think about working, we would, we would try and avoid work. We would sit there and drink a cup of coffee, chat about the news, we would do the crossword, we would read newspapers, anything to avoid that awful moment of actually having to write something funny down on paper. And Sometimes, during the course of that hour and a half or so of doing almost nothing, an idea would emerge that led us on to a sketch. But this particular morning, nothing had really emerged. We had, therefore, decided that we would resort to our final tactic, which was to open up Roger's thesaurus and merely stare at words. They sometimes sparked off ideas. For instance, the whole of the cheese shop sketch came straight out of Roger's thesaurus. Very, very grateful we were to it too. We just thought we were staring at words, and the word we were staring at that morning was anger. Anger, 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 we felt. Anger, what should we write about? John was quite keen on this because it's an emotion he portrays particularly well. But we couldn't really see what to do with anger. We had been talking that morning, however, about a minister in the government, the Wilson government in Britain at that time, who'd just been appointed to ministerial rank, to cabinet rank, and clearly had no abilities at all. He hadn't actually been designated as minister for something like housing or anything responsible like foreign ministry or anything like that. So he hadn't got a title temporarily until, fortunately for him, about 2 or 3 weeks without any rain, and he then subsequently became minister for drought. The first time we'd ever had one of those, but the man was completely incompetent, so it was a reasonable sort of sinecure sort of job to give him. And it was very, very successful in this ministry because, of course, it rained. It rained so much that he subsequently became Minister for Flooding. Well, that sounds absolutely stupid, but it's quite true. His name was Dennis Powell. And that gave us the idea of some sort of silly ministry. Ministry of Anger, we thought. The Ministry of Anger. How could that go? But no, 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 that didn't really lead anywhere. And this day we were working at my house, which stands on a hill. And at that moment, precisely that moment, a gentleman whom I'd noticed the week before walked past my house up the hill, happened to do so that morning, and he had a very strange ability. He was somehow able to walk uphill while leaning backwards. Ordinary angle. Don't know how he managed to do it. I couldn't see the footwork at all. I ran out to try and get a glimpse of the footwork, but by the time I got outside, he disappeared. But came back in with the notion, silly walks. So, Ministry of Silly Walks. That was the thought. But by now, it was very nearly lunchtime, so we rang up Michael Palin and Terry Jones, and they wrote the sketch. Another question, maybe? Yeah.
How did the six of you come up with the name of Monty Python?
Yeah. How did we get the name for Monty Python's Flying Circus? Well, we were all busy trying to write the first 13 episodes of the series, and weren't desperately keen because we were panicking to get everything done in time before we went into the studio. We did write everything in advance. There was never really any improvisation. There wasn't the money for that, really. As I said, Boogie didn't give us much money. We only had an hour and a half to record each half-hour show in the studio. We weren't keen to spend a lot of time arguing about titles. There'd already been suggestions, things like Owl Stretching Time, a Toad Elevating Moment, and Sex and Violence, I remember. And Terry Jones came up with a nice one, which was A Horse, a Bucket, and a Spoon. I must say, I rather liked it, never understood, but rather liked it. We never got agreement on any of these titles, because obviously they were the ideas of individual members of the group, and being human beings, no one else would like them. They hadn't been their own ideas. So we weren't going to arrive at any conclusion on this, but then the head of comedy came into our shed and told us that he wouldn't leave until we'd given him a title one morning. Said that anyway, we had to include the word circus in the title. He wanted a title desperately because he had to have something to put in the TV magazine. And told us we had to use the word circus in the title because the BBC had loosely referred to the six of us wandering around the building as a circus, a kind of BBC joke, T-E-E. this word circus had appeared on contracts and it had appeared on interdepartmental memos and so on. And in a bureaucracy like that, it would have been a very expensive process to change all of that paperwork. Would have detracted from the budget from the next show. So we thought, well, all right, we'll accept, we'll swallow that, we'll use the word circus. We added a flying to it to make it sound less like a real circus and more like something to do with the First World War. And then added Monty Python because he sounded like a really bad theatrical agent. Just the sort of guy that, that might have got us together. And also the, you know, the very hungry, huge, constricting snake wasn't a bad image either. So that was it. None of us liked it, but none of us hated it. So it was a typical committee decision, really. So. Yes?
Eric Idle and Terry Jones both seem to have appeared in the American market since The Meaning of Life came out. Are they still active in the British entertainment world?
Well, maybe they didn't ever have to work again. I don't know. If that's the case, I'm certainly not on the same financial scheme. So what is Eric doing? Eric actually is appearing... I think he's finished his role now. He's appearing in a movie that Terry Gilliam is making called The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which is somewhat running over budget a weeny bit, as you might have expected from what I said earlier. It started off around about 25 million and is now up to around nearly 40, I think. He's got his work cut out with that one. Well, good luck to him though. I mean, undoubtedly it will look wonderful and might well fool the critics again, but it has put a lot of strain on it. To make your money back on a movie, you basically have to make three times what you spent on it, and that's a lot. But anyway, yes, Eric was playing a role in that movie, and one of the reasons I think why the budget got a little out of control is that Terry decided to shoot it in Italy, and as I've already explained, Terry has slight difficulty communicating in English in Italy, an Italian camera crew, and for some reason, known only to himself, had a German sound crew, which could have led to difficulties during the first week or so of shooting, and did in fact during the first week, also partly, I think one of the sets wasn't ready, but then Terry's solution to this was to take the entire polyglot unit and go and shoot in Spain. must have multiplied the language problems even more. And so Eric Idle found himself sitting in a village in Spain with only one telephone in it, with his head shaved for this role and a couple of teeth missing. So I don't think he's terribly happy at the moment. And it's probably all grown back and he's probably quite gleeful by now. But other than that, I can't really say, no, I'm not really sure what Terry's been up to, what Eric's been up to. Does like lazing around in the south of France quite a bit, though. And also, the Terry Jones. What's Terry Jones been up to? Terry Jones has written the movie and is currently looking for finance for it, a movie called Eric the Viking. And also wrote a series of fairy tales for an English publishing house. But anyway, that was quite well received. So that's what those two are up to. Who else is left? Michael Palin. He's looking for finance for a movie, to a serious movie he tells me called An American Friend. He has been acting a fair bit, though. He was in a rather nice movie called A Private Function. I enjoyed that, very funny, I thought. And also, that's one of, that reminds me of something else that Terry Jones has been doing. He did direct a movie called, what was it called? Pleasure something. Anyway, it was about a prostitute.
Private Service.
Yes, right. Private services, private special services, something like that.
Personal
services. We got it. That was the well-known movie. I liked it though, actually, because it showed quite a realistic portrayal of the services prostitute renders, as opposed to the ones that people imagine that prostitutes give to their clients. This was quite an open, honest one, and quite joyful, I think, even though it's not a terribly attractive thing to watch. It was very human, and none the worse for that. It made sex seem quite a lot of fun, which people think it isn't these days. It's all taken rather seriously, as though there were never any such thing as a venereal disease before AIDS. Which, of course, there were. That does strike me as extraordinary. There's so much panic about AIDS. I was worried enough about hepatitis, weren't you? Syphilis is no breeze, I mean. I tried to keep clear of a lot of them. But people do panic. Never mind. Have I missed anyone out? John Cleese. Yes, he's just made a movie called A Fish Called Wanda. as you guessed, a comedy. that has Michael Palin in it, and it's a sort of detective yarn, I believe. That should be due out in the late fall of this year. I think that's rounded them all up, pretty much. Yes?
Do you like Span?
Do I like Span? not very much. There was a phase when I did, I suppose, that sort of coincided with the, well, I was quite young then, but it was the end of the Second World War, when we did get sent quite large quantities of Span over to Britain to help us out. You know. Very good thing, too. There wasn't much else to eat, so Span was certainly okay. But, of course, we did go overboard about it with one rather strange sketch. written by Michael Palin and Terry Jones, that one, I believe, yes. I've recently come into contact with Span again, oddly enough. I went to Minneapolis to give a talk like this at the Guthrie Theatre there, and had obviously some advance warning had got out about the asking for abuse at the beginning of these lectures, because I didn't need to ask for it. I just walked out and it arrived. Including a whole lot of debris, including quite a lot of Span. some of it, unfortunately, still in cash. Which took a bit of dodging. But it was quite a pleasant evening, nonetheless. It actually hit me, the melon did, but the can of Span did. And it's quite messy when it hits you, too. Some of it that wasn't in the cans did. But anyway, Span. Another question? Yeah.
Were you disappointed with the way The Magic Christian turned out?
The Magic Christian, yes, that was John and myself, that was our first involvement with movies in any shape or form. I suppose because of some writing we'd done for Frost Report, we'd become noticed by Peter Sellers, who asked us to do a rewrite of a movie written by Terry Sutton called Magic Christian. And I've read the book and liked it, read the screenplay, and we both of us, John and I, thought there were problems there. And anyway, we were asked to do a specific job, which was to write in a part for Ringo Starr so that the financiers could find the money to make the movie. the way these things happen. So we wrote Ringo in as a kind of adopted son, an instantly adopted son, adopted by this incredibly wealthy man, Guy Grand, who I don't know whether you know the story, but he basically liked to mess people around who he thought deserved messing around and had the money to do it, and just had a great deal of fun doing absurd things to people. But it was a bit of an ordeal by fire as an introduction to movie making, because we found that we'd written some pretty good stuff, which we were quite pleased with, but then discovered on the very first day of shooting, for instance, that there's one whole sequence involving Ringo and Peter, which took place at Sotheby's, the auctioneering establishment in London, where some priceless exhibits were being auctioned and were also on show. And Ringo had quite a nice section with Peter at the beginning of this sequence. They were going around this place with a shopping trolley. and Peter decided that he only liked noses for portraits. So these very expensive portraits, which he could afford to pay for, he would just cut the nose out, much to the distraction of the art expert, who loved them, of course, for art, but also he loved money, he discovered, and was forced to allow the man to cut just the noses out. Well, this little sequence went rather well, particularly with Ringo wandering around casting these priceless exhibits into his shopping trolley, as though it were a supermarket. And then we went into the auction proper sequence. Well, the very next day we all watched the rushes for that, and they've got a lot of love. But mysteriously, the next day it had to be shot again, leaving out the earlier sequence, which John and I had added, just keeping the auction sequence, on the grounds that Peter thought he hadn't quite got his character right. But I subsequently suspect maybe it was something to do with Ringo getting a lot of laughs. These little things do happen. people are human. Peter was brilliant, very, very funny man. But all of us basically have feet of clay at one time or another, and do make these little human errors. So that was a kind of a strange introduction to movies, and a lot of stuff we'd written for that movie bit the dust for quite the wrong reason, I think. But we used some of it later on. I mean, we did find in that. Well, I mean, for instance, to give you one example, John and I had written a little sequence about, which was actually partly suggested by Dieter. We wrote a little sequence about a man who was a very nervous man, not at all a social animal, who found himself at a party and felt a little unease, and so sat down, but unfortunately sat down on the hostess's Pekingese dog, thus killing him. Therefore having a bit of a difficult situation to explain his way out of. Then Peter read this scene and liked it very much indeed. I mean, laughed hysterically at it. And then the next day when we came back to see Peter, he'd gone off it totally because he'd actually read this piece of script to the man who delivered his milk, and he hadn't laughed. So it was out. We thought, well, is that the way we're going to be judged? How are we going to sort this film out? So it was, I mean, but Peter, to be fair, was in a very difficult situation. I mean, at that point, he was regarded as the funniest man in the world. Well, who did he go to for advice, you know? Well, the milkman, why not? Who the hell do you go to when you're in that position? Very, you know, when people are put on pedestals, I think they are in a very peculiar situation, and you've got to be some brain to think your way out of that problem sensibly and remain on an even keel, I think. Anyway, yes, one last question, I think, yeah?
How did you come up with the idea for the Liar's Autobiography?
The Liar's Autobiography really came about, I was at the age of 37. No, I wasn't quite 37, 36, I suppose. This is 11 years now since I stopped drinking, but at that point, 36, so I thought I would start writing an autobiography because I didn't think I was going to last much longer. It didn't perturb me. It didn't worry me that I was going to perhaps be dead in 3 or 4 or 5 years maximum. In fact, I thought I'd die at the age of 42. That was kind of what I thought then. And it didn't worry me at all. It's stupid, isn't it? But there we are. I did get out of 40, but that meant I'd started to write this autobiography just to get a few things down, really. The writing didn't progress very quickly because I was drinking quite torrentially at that point. But after I'd sobered up, the writing progressed very much more quickly, and there was kind of a cathartic experience to be able to write that and therefore have to think back about my life and how this had all happened in the first place. So it was also quite an enjoyable process. So I called it a Liar's Autobiography, in fact, because I realised very quickly, very early on, that it's almost impossible to tell the truth. Not because of reasons of libel, although a title like that certainly would help, I thought, to protect me in some measure, but also because truth changes in an odd way. I know that sounds like nonsense, but truth, which is truth to you, can then, 3 or 4 years later, when you go back to look at that same situation, you're looking at it then from a different perspective, and it actually changes. And I began to realise this while writing, and it certainly changes from the point of view of someone else's perspective. You know, I could write my version of what happened one afternoon, and someone else who was there would have quite a different version. They'd agree on certain points, but it'd be quite dramatically different, even though both could swear that they were telling the truth. Well, who was right? So I couldn't really swear that I was right, and particularly with all that alcohol having on side, I decided the truthful thing to do would be to call it a Liar's Autobiography. And anyway, I was contemplating writing it with other people, and therefore I thought that title would be a good way at least get me out of the problem of writing an autobiography with several other co-authors. So, that was the way that came about. I've talked about a couple of moments which had great impact on me personally. One, a moment of amazing embarrassment, which occurred during the filming of Life of Brian, which we, of course, filmed in Tunisia, which is in North Africa. And most people in Tunisia happen to be Muslim people. They're Mohammedan folks. And I'd just spent the whole day as Brian being chased by a whole load of followers I had no wish to have, and then eventually managed to escape them to spend the very first night with my newly acquired girlfriend, Judith Iscariot. And had a wonderful, wonderful night and woke up the next morning full of the joys of spring and totally naked, threw open the shutters, only to discover this huge band of followers waiting outside for me. Well, the matter of genital exposure was no particular problem to me. I am a doctor, after all. But, but there was a problem in that we had a crowd of Tunisian extras. We had some 300 people posing as 600. And half of that number, almost half of them anyway, were women. And Muslim women are forbidden by Muslim law to see such things, you see. It's absolutely forbidden by Muslim law for them to see such sights. So when I flung open the shutters, half the crowd ran away screaming. And a profound I'd like to think it was the religion anyway. I'm sure it was. certainly. Another moment concerned a complaint. We didn't really have many complaints about the Python television series, but I do remember one in particular because it concerned myself. And it was written by a very, very angry lady from Newcastle in England. You could tell the rage of this person's heart from the very anger in each letter that she'd written in this letter. And it concerned an appearance I'd made on a talk show in England, hosted by a gentleman called George Melly. Now, George Melly is an English jazz singer, if that's not a contradiction in terms. A very good jazz singer, actually, and a full Renaissance man, really. I mean, he's also an expert in fine arts and a very good author and a general sort of bon vivant. And his notion for this talk show was that he should only invite onto it people whom he knew, not only so that he wouldn't have to do a whole load of research, but also so that he wouldn't have to have a clipboard full of notes or anything, and could just have a very casual conversation with his guests, and thus hopefully bringing the best out of them. And also to that end, the hospitality before these shows was of formidable proportions. I mean, there are incredible quantities of alcohol freely available, and also other things too, of course, because he was a musician. This meant that I appeared on this show in a very relaxed frame of mind. George had just been talking while on the show about a book he'd written called Owning Up, in which he'd admitted to taking part, to indulging in certain practices while he was a member of Her Majesty's Navy. Not that that sort of thing happens in the British Navy. It does not. It never has, and it never will. And neither does cannibalism. Anyway, I had gone on in this relaxed mood to admit myself that I'd taken part in similar activities in my past, and that was the substance of this lady's complaint. She wrote to the Python office, we had one by then, wrote to the Python office saying that someone from Monty Python had appeared, someone from Monty Python hadn't had the courage to give his name. I mean, that was monstrous, really, because obviously George had introduced me as Graham Chapman and spoken to me as Graham throughout, and at the end of the programme, there it said, talking to George Melly was Graham Chapman, but never mind, anyway. But hadn't had the courage to give his name, was evidently homosexual, and therefore deserved eternal hellfire and damnation from this moment. And it went on in similar fire and brimstone tones for about 2.5 pages. And then after that, she didn't finish there. She included 25 sheets of paper on which were written prayers, which if this person said every day for the rest of his life, he might attain some kind of purgatory. That was her best offer. Well, Eric Idle had a wonderful idea and wrote back to her saying, we've found out which one it was and we've killed him. It's interesting to note that the next six programmes we did were the last six programmes we ever did, which were the ones without John Cleese in them. So I'm not sure what she made of that, and I don't care. Anyway, good night to you.